Hello and welcome to Gilmore Ball Z, the podcast where I show my wife Dragon Ball Z, she shows me Gilmore Girls, and we both try to find some kind of common ground. I'm Grant.
And I'm Paige.
And this week we watched episode 132 of Dragon Ball Z Kai, and season 6, episode 11 of Gilmore Girls. So, Paige, what happened this week on Dragon Ball Z Kai?
Yeah, there were a couple plots on this week, so let's get the plot that won't matter out of the way first. Kabuto told Gohan repeatedly that he can't pull the sword out. He's stupid for thinking he should pull the sword out. The sword is so great. Gohan tries to pull the sword out of the stone in his normal non-Super Saiyan form, which seems like an odd choice. But finally, after being knocked over and throwing out his back, trying to lift it normally, he goes Super Saiyan 2, he's able to maybe tap into Rage, it's once again unclear, and he's able to pull this great sword out of a stone, and he can't hold it, and he can't figure out how to fight with it because it's so heavy. And Kabuto says, oh, there's something wrong with you, the sword is great, why would there be any problems with a sword? And Gohan's like, you want to hold it? You can try holding it. And Kabuto cannot hold it. Meanwhile, back on the watchtower, Goten and Trunks obviously have woken up from what the narrator calls a peaceful slumber, which is a weird, like, word for getting knocked out by your father, but okay. They're awake and Goku tries to teach them fusion, and they have reasonable questions like, hello, why were you not there when my older brother father figure and my actual father figure were murdered? He has no good answers except I was knocked out, because they don't believe him. Piccolo goes full-on gruff dad and says, well, you shouldn't, hey, don't. And for once, Goku is actually the better dad, and he actually says, hey, it's totally fair to have those questions. Let's try to figure it out. It looks like things aren't going to work until everybody gets another psychic blast from Babidi and Boo. Babidi is declaring that Boo is going to kill another entire town by turning everyone into, I thought he said chocolate balls, which is a thing, I guess.
What are they called?
Lindor truffles.
Yeah, like a little Lindor. Those are chocolate balls.
Yeah, those are chocolate balls and they're real good. No, he said chocolate bars.
Which does make more sense.
He turns, there was a throwaway line that said that, like, millions of people into chocolate bars. And millions of people is apparently enough to give Boo a rumbly tummy. His tummy's upset, so next time they're just going to destroy the town without trying to get anyone's attention first. This is the first time that Goten and Trunks have seen this message. And Trunks responds exactly like you'd expect Vegeta's son to respond. He yells back like, hey, I'm Trunks. He's like, okay, what about it? He's like, don't mess with me, and I'm gonna kill you. And this tiny kid voice. That is not the only message he gets back, though. We get a character who I did not think was coming back. The redneck mom and her two redneck kids. Now, I say the redneck mom because even when she's asked to identify herself, she identifies herself as the mother of her children and a member of the PTA. She gives their names, not hers. Which is weird because we hear her say this to Babidi. She calls in on the Babidi phone because she remembers this Trunks kid. She remembers not liking him. And she remembers that he came from, I think, West Town? I did not take a note of
West
that.
West City.
West City, sorry. And he lives on the capsule compound. So she calls in and gives Babidi this information. And Babidi doesn't like her as a person, but is grateful for this information.
Yeah, why didn't Babidi explode her head?
You know, that's a great question. Because her information was actually actionable. Probably. The last guy did not have actionable information. So the last time we see Babidi and Boo, they are heading towards West City to kill everyone on the capsule compound. And if you'll remember, Bulma's parents, Trunks' grandparents, are still there with all their animals. So Trunks is very understandably concerned. Meanwhile, on the watchtower, Videl is still grieving. Videl is experiencing two of the stages of grief at once, and those stages are anger and denial. She is angry why everyone for thinking that Gohan is dead and does not believe he's dead until she sees a body. Chi-Chi is experiencing a lesser-known stage of grief, which is called fainting. Chi-Chi's just laid out on a couch. Ox King is bumbling around. Basically, he seems more worried about how Chi-Chi's doing than the fact that his grandson is dead. I mean, I understand him not worrying that Goku is dead, but you'd think he'd care that Gohan is dead after he was raising his grandson for, you know, the last 7 years or so after Goku died. But, you know, whatever. Ox King, you do you. But now Trunks and Goten are taking this seriously now that they've seen Babidi's message and his willingness to kill everybody. We get a good 10 seconds in this episode of children watching genocide and trying to grapple with man's inhumanity to man. It's a really weird pull for a kids show, but that's Dragon Ball. They are willing and ready to go fusion. So the first thing that Goku tells them to do is to, like, just, he wants to gauge their max power levels. If they go all out, what does their power level look like? It turns out that Trunks' is a little higher than Goten's, which makes sense because he's about a year older. And so Goku has to ask him to bring it down a smidge. It's a very, like, arranging furniture kind of scene because it's like, I need to bring it down a smidge. No, up a smidge. No, down a smidge. Okay, you got it right there. He's got his power level perfectly matched with Goten's. Which leads to Chi-Chi, like, overprotective mom jumping in and saying, why are you having my little Trunks bring his power level down? And you get Goten promising to try to bring his power level up to match Trunks. But really what matters is that now they've figured out where they can match their power levels, and it is still much more powerful than most people would expect kids to have. We get a weird little side thing where Krillin imagines what it would be like if he knew about fusion when he and Goku were kids, or when he was an adult and Goku was a kid. I don't know the Dragon Ball ages, but when Goku was a child, more on that in a second. But then we end this episode with Goten and Trunks ready to do fusion. And Goku says for the first time when they're figuring out the technique, he's just going to have them fuse when they're in their base form, not Super Saiyan. And that's where we end things. What happened this week on Gilmore Girls?
Oh, geez. A lot happened on Gilmore Girls this week. So we had a Rory plot, a Lorelai plot, and a Luke plot, and a small Lane plot. And I'm actually going to save the Lane plot for last. I usually do it first, but I'm going to save it for last on this one.
Because it was the only thing that gave us joy.
It was the only thing I actually enjoyed in this episode. So Rory. Rory is getting all her shit together and getting started back at Yale. And that means she's moving. She's lived in like four places in four episodes, it feels like. Because she's moving out of her old childhood home, out of Lorelai's house, and into the spare room in Paris and Doyle's apartment.
Right, so the four places are the grandparents' house, Lane's apartment, her mom's house, and now the
Paris.
Dorm.
Yeah.
Or yeah, and then now the apartment on camp, or 10 minutes away from campus.
Yeah. So we get a delightful scene at the beginning of where the cold open is that they just came back from their 21st birthday belated party in Atlantic City. That doesn't really matter, but they did their thing with the 21 things and the playing 21. And
getting 21 numbers.
21 phone numbers. That's what they were talking about in that previous episode.
I mean, to be fair, that feels like a more appropriate version for, you know, at least one of them not being single than the original was.
That's true. So, after the real opening of the episode is Rory getting ready to move out, and I need to stop everything, and we need to talk about this scene.
Yeah, we really do.
Now, normally, this is not the kind of podcast where we do the CinemaSins thing and, like, point out every little inconsistency and ding it and pretend that makes us smart. Like,
that coffee cup definitely didn't have coffee in it.
Ding. Like, you know, I have fun. We have fun nitpicking here and there occasionally, but we don't usually get too anal retentive about it. But this scene, I have to stop and talk about it.
So weird.
Because it's so obvious and so surreal.
So first, what's happening in the scene?
Yeah, so nothing's happening in the scene. What's happening in the scene is Rory's packing up her car and getting ready to move into her new place. That is the only thing happening in the scene. The scene did not need to exist, and it certainly did not need to be as long as it was. But, like, at the very beginning and at the very end of the scene, Lorelai and Rory are interacting, but for the whole middle where they're talking by the car, they're never on camera at the same time.
No.
And it's in a way that is very, very obvious, where I guess they must have had to do reshoots or something and couldn't get Alexis and Lauren on set at the same time for some reason, because... Yeah. Not only is the camera constantly panning back and forth between the two of them in a way that makes it really obvious they're not actually in the same room.
Yeah, it almost looks like they're not looking at each other.
Yeah, they're not quite looking at each other, and just, like, just they're not properly reacting to each other. Like, they're both obviously just reading a script. Like, yeah. You can really just tell that they're not actually playing off of each other in the way that they usually do that makes their banter scenes really strong.
Yeah.
So, the whole... You can't really put your finger on what it is, but the whole scene just has a weird, awkward tone to it because of that.
And even just, like, the lighting is weird. Like, one of them shot at night with artificial light, or one of them was put through the Wizard of Oz filter. I don't know. It looks weird.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, the lighting is obviously different between the two of them. And so this whole scene that normally would be, like, a fun, cute mother-daughter banter scene... just ends up feeling awkward and surreal in a way you can't quite put your finger on. So while the scene was happening, I was like, they're not on set together. And Paige said, let me look. And she Googled it. And so because she was looking at, was it like a Reddit thread or something?
Yeah, it was a whole Reddit thread just on this scene in this episode.
Yeah, so she knew to have us look for a detail that I would imagine most people miss because it's the kind of detail you don't notice, but... Gilmore Girls fans, I need you to go back and rewatch this scene. Rory gets
so this is season 6, episode 11, the first scene after the cold open, the very end of the scene.
Yeah, so at about 7 minutes into the episode, Rory gets into the car, shuts the door, and drives away, and Lorelai's, like, waving, watching her go, and then it cuts from, like, Lorelai's face to over Lorelai's shoulder so you can see the car driving away. And the hand at the steering wheel is very obviously not Alexis Bledel.
Yeah, not only, like, Alexis Bledel was wearing, like, a chunky, a wool sweater.
She's wearing gloves because it's wintertime, right?
And gloves because it's wintertime. It's like a heavy coat and gloves.
Yeah, but then when the camera pans over, it is very obviously, like, it was probably just, like, some stagehand in the back or something. Because it's obviously, like, a large man wearing a big chunky gold wristwatch.
And, like, sleeveless.
Yeah. Like, just is driving away. So that's not important. I needed to stop and marvel over it because it's amazing the little things that you notice when shows cut corners on stuff like that that doesn't make the episode worse. Like, we're not saying this is a bad episode because of it, but it's just funny to see those little ways where, like, a lot of times television will be very careful about tracking those kinds of things for continuity. And somebody clearly dropped the ball on that, which I thought was funny. But anyway, not actually important to the episode.
No.
So Rory's plot in this episode is mostly just about her getting settled into the new status quo of her returning to Yale. Her apartment with Paris and Doyle is obviously in, like, a really bad neighborhood and is just a dingy, kind of crappy apartment.
Or at least just a jank neighborhood.
Yeah, well, like, there are regularly gunshots heard down the street in her neighborhood.
It's not great.
There's a group of people living on the ground floor of the apartment that we never see, and we don't actually get what they're supposed to be. It's unclear if the joke is that they're a gang or that they're, like, cooking meth or whatever, but everyone just, like, the joke is, oh, just tell your visitors they're a doo-wop group. So it's just, like, kind of sketchy residence, kind of sketchy neighborhood. And Paris has, like, 4 deadbolts that you need to unlock in a certain order and kick the door twice. I'm not quite sure what that's up with.
That could be just so Paris won't shoot you.
Maybe that's just so Paris won't shoot you when you come through the door. The inside of the place is messy and dingy and crappy. And Paris and Doyle are exactly the kind of roommates you would expect them to be. Namely, that they've taken up Krav Maga classes, so they will assault each other, like, sneak attack each other into a Krav Maga sparring match with safe words. So
this is what this show has become. Think about, just stop for a second and think about season 1 Paris watching this.
Well, I don't know. Season, was it 2 or 3 Paris decided to let out her frustrations with Rory through homoerotic fencing?
Right, but that's like, very elite. Like, fighting with her boyfriend. Anyway, it feels weird when you think back to where she was for me.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like Paris's character arc so far is the only one I actually believe.
Fair.
But anyway, so that's a thing. Paris has now taken over the Yale Daily News, and she's running a ridiculously tight ship where, like, nobody's allowed to talk or have personal effects at their desk or anything like that. But she does get Rory back on the features beat, and she's, you know, doing her thing. And so then Logan shows up.
He showed up once before.
That's true, actually, yeah. Earlier in the episode, Rory is touring around campus trying to get herself signed up for the right number of courses so she can catch up on the term she missed. And she runs into Logan at the coffee cart. And he gets up and is like, "Hey, Ace, I knew you'd have to get coffee eventually." And she just turns around and walks away.
So he's been creeping at the coffee cart.
Yeah, I like Rory, this new Rory who actually treats Logan the way she should. I know she's not going to be around forever, but I'm enjoying her while she's here.
Yep.
He also turns up late at the newspaper and, like, does this weird thing where he just, like, kind of tries to reach out and touch her.
Yeah.
Like, he just reaches out and tries to touch her arm and she shrinks away from him like, "No, dude, we're broken up and you're a fucking asshole."
Yeah, it's creepy. Like, it's not even that invasive of touch, except that it is just touch. But the way he does it just feels so weird. So even though it's just an arm touch, it feels gross.
Yeah, he's the worst. And then again, she's like going back to her apartment to drop some stuff off because I guess the standard operating procedure at Yale, if somebody leaves and then comes back, is they do have to do one appointment with the school therapist just to talk through transitioning back in, why they took a gap, what's going on, things like that. So while she's at her apartment, just like trying to get in, Logan is waiting for her in the hallway outside her apartment.
Which means he's found out where her apartment is.
Yeah, I really want to know how he found out where she lives. There's no good answer to that question. And he's like, "Are we going to talk about this, Ace?" And she's like, "No, fuck you. You're in the..." I love this. She was like, "Mr. Life and Death Brigade doesn't have the courage to break up with his girlfriend. He has his sister do it for him." Which, like, I love Logan getting absolutely roasted as the spineless piece of shit he actually is. And he's like, I just told her that to get her off my back. I needed to think about things. I don't like being the kind of guy who yells at you in the middle of a restaurant." Then don't be the kind of guy who yells at your girlfriend in the middle of a restaurant, you piece of shit.
And don't make it seem like it's your girlfriend's responsibility to deal with that.
Yeah, like, we're at a season and a half of this guy, and I'm still waiting for one scene that redeems him. I
thought we had one scene that out of context he didn't seem so bad.
Maybe, but whatever.
We had that.
It's not enough. Like,
no.
I'm waiting for him to do one good thing and he still hasn't. I genuinely don't understand anybody who likes this guy. I don't. I can't wrap my head around how anybody can see this relationship and go, "Yeah, this is my Rory OTP." I can't. I don't. It's not possible. But anyway, then he does what all Rory boyfriends do under duress, say that he loves her. And she just tells him to leave and goes back into her apartment. And presumably he does leave because when she then comes out a couple minutes later, he's not there. And she goes to the therapist and the therapist is like, "Hey, I'm going to ask you a series of incredibly invasive personal questions right out the gate without getting you any time to get comfortable."
Which, it's really bad therapy.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about therapy, but I feel like that's not good therapisting.
No.
I mean, I know that bad therapists exist, so I'm not going to say this scene is unrealistic.
Especially on campuses.
I'm not going to say this scene is unrealistic because I'm sure... I know that actually, as far as the spectrum of real-world therapists goes, this dude was probably sadly middling. But
there should be some ramp-up.
Yeah, still not good therapy happening here. And Rory has a meltdown that I feel like was supposed to be at least a little bit dramatic, but was really just hilarious. Because it's just Rory rightfully saying what the audience has been saying for the last season and a half. and cartoonishly crying about it. Like, I'm genuinely not sure if we were supposed to feel bad for Rory in that scene, or if she was supposed to be the subject of ridicule.
Yeah, it was really hard to tell.
Yeah, because, like, this episode in general, and I feel like this show in general, doesn't treat mental health and the need for therapy as, like, super sensitively.
No.
There's a lot of talk of, like, I'm crazy, and then Rory's like, Rory talks to Lorelai later and is like, the therapist says I should come back and see him every week for the next 8 weeks. And Lorelai's like, wait a minute, what? I'm so sorry. Like, this is some big deal that she has to talk to a therapist?
Yeah, the what should be that the therapist actually has enough bandwidth to see her that many times, which is great.
That's pretty damn great for a campus therapist. So yeah, Rory is going to go see the campus therapist now. I think that's everything that happened to Rory in this episode, really.
Yeah.
Lorelai was like, let's start wedding planning. And so then Lorelai and Suki started wedding planning.
Anytime Luke tried to have an opinion on his wedding, he got pushed out by Suki.
Yeah. And so they like Lorelai and Suki go out in a little outing to go find stuff. And they find the perfect dress. Like, they go into a bridal shop and there's a dress that Lorelai immediately falls in love with. Kind of an ugly dress, but whatever. And she tries it on.
There's no clerk in this shop. It's a really weird scene.
Yeah, she tries it on and it's perfect. So they buy it and then like, okay, it's strapless. So summer wedding. So daisies. Oh, hey, invitations that are perfectly daisies. All right, let's go stop and have a bite to eat. Wait a minute. Here's this church. It's perfect. And it's open on this date that doesn't clash with anybody's previous obligations. And they also have a rec space in the back and a carousel so we can do the wedding and reception all at the same place. And they have a caterer and Suki signs off on the caterer. So like they just plan the entire wedding in one afternoon. Like,
yep.
Just fate converges and they find everything to make the perfect wedding in one afternoon.
I'm glad that Suki and Lorelai's marriage will be beautiful.
Yeah, right? Like, Luke has no opinions.
Nope.
Or, like, he has opinions, but he's not allowed to voice them, which is just such a stereotype.
Weddings are for the bride.
For the bride, 100%. The groom should have no say. He doesn't care.
Men can't do anything about weddings. That's why we don't let them.
Yep. And so then she starts doubting herself because she's like, wait a minute. But I always freak out and screw things up in relationships. I freaked out and screwed things up with Max, which is just the most hilarious revisionist history this show has ever tried to pull off. And it's not the first time they've tried to tell us that. They've repeatedly tried to sell us this line that the reason that the Lorelai-Max relationship didn't work was because Lorelai freaked out and ruined it. And not that Max, like, repeatedly manipulated and pressured her into pushing the relationship faster than she was comfortable with.
Yeah.
And also was just boring.
Yeah.
And so she starts to second guess herself, blah, blah, blah. So Luke comes over to talk to her about something else, which we'll get to. And she's like, Luke, I need you to see the dress. And he's like, I don't want to see the dress. It's bad luck. And then she comes down in the dress. So we see her in the dress and we still see that it's not a great dress.
It's fine.
Like the weird ruffly stuff on the top half clashes with everything on the bottom half.
That's true.
And the, like, midsection of it is just awkwardly shaped, so it makes her look like she has a poochy stomach.
It does make her look... Yeah, it makes her look poochy.
Yeah, like...
Not that there's anything wrong with women being poochy,
no,
but, like...
No, but it
is... It's not a flattering cut.
It is a dress that is not flattering on her body. And it should not be that hard to find a dress that is flattering on Lauren Graham.
No.
She is a very, very attractive lady. And he's just like, you're perfect. And they kiss. And she's like, well, I like this dress then. And that's the Lorelai plot. Luke plot. He's like, I'm still feeling conflicted about having a daughter. So he shows up at their house. And April's not in the house, but Anna is. So we get to meet Anna. She looks oddly like the lady that was dating Jess's dad in that backdoor Jess pilot.
Also, like Curly's wife in the 1992 Of Mice and Men with John Malkovich.
Which was a great version of Mice and Men. So here we learn that Luke has a type, and that is hot brunette moms.
Well, she wasn't a mom when he started dating her.
No, but seeing her,
she just made her into a mom.
He definitely has a type. Like, she is a pretty brunette lady, and she's pretty in very much the same way that Lorelai is.
And also not entirely dissimilar from Rachel.
I genuinely don't remember what Rachel looked like, but I
believe also
you.
A brunette who is kind of similar to Lauren Graham.
Yeah. They get to talking for a little bit, and she's like, hey, Luke, how's it going? Blah, blah, blah. They chit-chat, and then he's like, okay, Anna, why didn't you tell me? And she's like, okay, we're talking about this. They sit down, they drink some tea, and she's like, look, I didn't find out until after we'd broken up. I knew you hated kids. I didn't want to drag you down like that. I knew I could handle it on my own, and I have. And he's like, but I would have helped. Like, I would have helped you if you told me. And she's like, I know, but we don't need anything. We don't need anything. We don't want anything. We never have. I've always been able to take care of her. I've always been able to handle it on my own. We're okay on our own. You really don't need to feel bad about this. But Luke insists. He insists. He insists. He says, I want to help. Like, I understand if you want to have your life. I understand if you don't want me to have contact. Like, I get it. But I feel like I need to at least live up to my end of the bargain by helping out, even if it's just pitching in a little bit of money. I want to help.
Yeah.
And Anna finally relents. It's like, okay, fine. If it'll, like, I don't need anything, but if it'll really make you feel better, I will let you help. Like, I will accept your money.
You could even say, like, college fund.
Yeah, right? But like, that kid definitely wants to go to college.
And she might get a full scholarship, but a college fund can't hurt.
No.
Like, you can still spend that on books.
Yeah, books, or even just, like, rent. Like, she also mentions that, you know, oh, she's really smart. She did that whole experiment all on her own. Like, she dug around in my stuff and found my old letters to track down the potential fathers, which kind of closes that plot hole. Although I feel like that's still not... I feel like...
There's still questions.
There's still questions, because it seems like she never had any doubt that Luke was the father. So if April was going through her old diaries or something, she would probably have found, I'm pregnant and Luke is the father. Do I tell him? But yeah. Anyway, and she, you know, just did all of that without me ever finding out about it. Like, I wouldn't have sprung that on you if I'd known she was going to do it. But she also mentions that April, like, is so smart. She has her own website, because this is back when that was still, like, impressive. It was before Facebook. Then later, Luke gets Kirk to help him get on the internet, because this is, you know, back when you needed somebody to help you get on the internet.
Obviously doesn't have a computer.
Back when going on the internet was a verb. And he looks at April's website, and it's just a bunch of photos of her doing science-y stuff throughout the years. So we get, like, little April with test tubes and bigger April and just all this stuff of April. And Luke sees all of that, and you can see his heart grow 3 sizes. So he calls Anna, and he's like, look, I looked at all her pictures. I want contact. And Anna's like, what? He's like, I want to be in her life. I want a relationship with her. Like, you didn't tell me she has my nose. And...
But you think that Luke would have noticed when he met her, but whatever.
I mean, if he had time to really, really stop and look at the photos, he may have noticed in a way that he didn't notice in 2 relatively short social interactions with her.
It's true.
I'd believe it. And so Anna says, like, I mean, April's 12, 13 years old now. Like, she can make that decision for herself, but if she's okay with it, I'm okay with it. I have no problem with you having a relationship with her. And so he makes plans to call later that night to talk to April. So then he goes to Lorelai's, and when he goes to Lorelai's, he says, hey, I gotta tell you something. But then when she comes down in this perfect wedding dress, just, oh, pretty lady, ideas leave my head, and he just never brings it up with her. For reasons not thoroughly explored. And that's how the episode ends. Really quick Lane plot. Lane is grumpy. Lane is being even more dour and aggressive than Mrs. Kim is. She loudly throws Zach out of the store when he tries to come over to get one of his CDs back, because she's now living with her mom again. And so the end of the episode, Mrs. Kim is like, Lane, she closes up the store. It's like, Lane, we need to talk. She closes all of the curtains on every single window in the house and, like, pushes an armoire in front of one that doesn't have a curtain, goes into the kitchen, climbs up to the top shelf of a cabinet, reaches way into the back and pulls out a bottle of sake and pours her and Lane both sake. And then is like, you have grieved for 6 weeks. It is time to move on. And they toast and drink sake. And then just like, oh, I'll pour you a little more. And they have two.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. That is what happened this week on Gilmore Girls. What did you think of this week's Dragon Ball Z Kai?
It's hard to tell with these episodes because I know I've said it before, but I'll say it again. It's like a series of things happening. Like, the tone is even more hard. Like, with Boo, the tone is even harder to pin down than most of Dragon Ball. Where, like, on one side you have the wackiness of Boo, like, turning people into chocolate bars. And you have people's fear about this not being like, I'm going to die and I never told my daughter I loved her. It's more like, I just bought a house. I live here. But on the other hand, it's horrifying that they're all being turned to chocolate and being eaten by the gaping maw of Boo while toddlers watch horrified and know that if they don't give themselves up, the world will burn. But if these children give themselves up, the world will also burn. It's real dark stuff.
It
is. So you got the really light, the really dark. You've got a couple of people grieving the death of family members. And they're I feel like they're engaging with it a little more than they have in the past. Especially because now Bulma's parents are threatened and her home is threatened. And Trunks has to decide what to do with that. But also then you've got this weird, wacky side plot where Gohan is trying to hold Mjolnir Excalibur. Like, it's definitely Excalibur and the pulling it out of a stone, but it's more Mjolnir in you have to be worthy enough to carry it or else it's too heavy. It's this weird, mythic kind of feel, and I have no idea what this show is going for anymore. I know I never did, but even less than I used to.
Yeah, the tone of this episode was kind of weird and all over the place, but at the same time, like, I kind of like it. Like, yes, it is silly that the things that the people in the city are worried about is, I just bought a house, and not like, oh god, we're gonna die.
That would get a little too dark.
Yeah, but like, yeah, that's like, weirdly, I just bought a house is the highest stakes thing in a Toriyama story. Because even if the people don't necessarily know this, we know that anybody who dies is going to get wished back by the Dragon Balls.
See, on one hand, there's that, but, like, we still have to watch them get brutally murdered. I mean, like, to go back to Marvel, when we watched Infinity War, we knew, like, that Spider-Man was going to come back, but when he looked at Tony and said, Mr. Stark, I don't feel so good, you hurt inside, because that is heartbreaking, and you know it's going to affect Tony for forever. Like, the fact that we all know they're going to come back is a weird reason for it not to have any weight.
Yeah, but, like, I don't know. It's this weird thing of Toriyama trying to do comedy and drama at the same time, and it kind of works in that it's kind of silly, but it kind of doesn't in that, you're right, there's this tonal dissonance to it.
Yeah.
But
I mean, like, those lines are funny, to be clear, but I just can't quite get a handle on it.
So that was kind of weird, but I gotta say, I really liked all of the Goten and Trunks stuff in this episode.
That's fair, yeah.
Like, I liked that that Goten and Trunks turned on Goku for a minute there.
That was really good, and I liked that Goku actually engaged well for once.
Yeah, but it was very like the kids don't like the babysitter.
Mm-hmm. And why would they have any connection to Goku? Everyone else does, but they have none.
Yeah, like Goten, yes, he's Goten's father, and like he seemed to warm up to him pretty quickly. But still, this is a guy that Goten's known for half a day.
Yep.
Like, it's important to remember that everything from the beginning of the World Martial Arts Tournament up to this has still the same day.
And, like, who cares if he met his real father? His father figure is dead.
Yeah. So, like, Goten doesn't really know this guy. He just knows he's supposed to trust him because his mom and his brother trust him. Trunks really doesn't know this guy. And probably, like, the only things he's probably ever heard about Goku, sure, half of it was from Bulma saying, oh, Goten's dad was a really great guy. But the other half of it came from Vegeta.
And I don't know if even Bulma would be quite that warm. Like, she would believe that, but that doesn't mean that's what she's saying.
I could believe that when she got in a reminiscent mood, Bulma would say kind things about Goku. Like,
that's possible.
Goku is Bulma's oldest friend.
That's true. So, but I feel like Bulma isn't necessarily someone to always talk kindly about her oldest friends.
No, but I believe she would, especially when he's dead. Like, she would say nice things about dead Goku.
Fair.
Especially to his kid. Like, she would tell Gohan, or she would tell Goten, your father was a really great guy. So Trunks has even less reason to give a shit what Goku thinks, because he's heard what Vegeta thought of Goku.
Yeah.
Like, Goku is the reason why Dad gets sad and angry sometimes.
Goku's why Dad drinks.
Pretty much. So, it was nice that they had that moment, and yeah, that Goku interacted with them constructively. And you mentioned it, but I actually really, really liked that little moment with Krillin.
Okay.
Because, so, Goku's like, all right, teaching them how to test out their power, which was a slow scene, but I didn't mind it. Like, I kind of liked that they actually engage with the mechanics of it, and, like, it was watching Goku be a teacher, which I thought was interesting.
Well, and I think one of the strengths of this scene, so let's stop and talk about it for 1 second before we get to Krillin, is that to work fusion, like, we had to get Trunks and Goten at the same level, which is not something they've ever tried to do before, because they've always tried to, like, try to beat each other. And so it was actually coming at it, like, this is one instance where the mechanics actually work together with character, and how these two boys would deal with having to cooperate instead of compete.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not unhealthy, you know, competition. It was always been friendship, but their friendship is built around competition, like Goku and Vegeta's friendship is. And so them having to engage with it in a new way did show us a different part of how they even view cooperating, kind of as an inner competition of, like, why can't he get up to my level? And you get to see Bulma as a mom and saying, like, don't tell my son to hold back. Why doesn't your son get better? Which is definitely how she got married to Vegeta.
Totally.
And all of that did do a thing. I should give it credit. That did do a thing that Dragon Ball doesn't often do, and I ask for it to do more, where it takes the mechanics of what's happening and actually, like, brings it in strong characterization.
Yeah, and it made me think of a couple episodes back that I brought up this notion of, like, Goten and Trunks really are what Goku and Vegeta could have been if they were raised under different circumstances.
Absolutely.
So yeah, like, that scene, it was quiet and slow, but I didn't mind it. I really enjoyed that scene.
Yeah. No, I would like more scenes like that, but I don't understand the Krillin scene, so tell me what you think of it.
So, okay. So yeah, so Bulma busts in, hey, don't tell my son to hold back. That could be dangerous. Like, I like that it wasn't just, don't tell my son to hold back, your son should get better. It was, don't tell my son to hold back when you're going to be throwing him at Boo.
Like, yeah, that's true.
That's dangerous. So it was Bulma being protective of her son. And Krillin has to step in and be like, Bulma, I know this is stressful. I know that we're all tense, but Goku knows what he's doing. Please let Goku do his thing. And Bulma starts laying into Krillin, and he's like, nope. And he just picks her up, throws her over his shoulder like Double Dragon, and carries her out of the room. Which is, it was just funny to see Krillin standing up to Bulma.
Yeah, I'm curious how the height actually works for that, because I feel like her feet would be on the floor, but it worked somehow.
It worked somehow. And I just, like, turn your stubby little legs around and put me down. It just, I don't know. I like seeing Krillin show off the fact that even though he's the weakest of the Z, or one of the weakest of the Z fighters, by normal human standards, he's ridiculously strong.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
But then, yeah, he has that moment of, like, huh, I wonder if Goku and I could have fused. And he reminisces to when he and Goku first trained with Master Roshi in the original Dragon Ball. And I don't know. I just thought it was a nice character moment for Krillin of, like, thinking back to what his and Goku's relationship is now versus what it was. Because when Krillin was first introduced, he was kind of cocky and kind of a dick to Goku. And so the Krillin we see now is actually a much more humbled Krillin than the one that was originally introduced. And so they originally had a dynamic not too dissimilar from Goten and Trunks. And he's thinking back to the last time he was stronger than Goku, which was a really, really long time ago. And I don't know, like, I don't have anything intelligent to say about that scene, but I just thought it was nice to get a moment of Krillin just thinking back on the person he used to be versus the person he is now, and just wondering, like, if it was Goku and I in the hot seat now, could we have accomplished the same thing these kids are about to accomplish.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It was a level of introspection we don't usually get out of Krillin. And so I thought it was a nice little moment for him.
I think the reason it didn't connect with me at that same level is it just felt so weird. And I think it's probably just because I have no context for the original Dragon Ball. And so it almost felt like, and I, you know, we've probably referenced it before, we're watching a lot of 30 Rock right now. It felt like a weird 30 Rock flashback.
A cutaway gag to 30 Rock?
Yeah, a cutaway gag flashback in 30 Rock, because, like, Krillin's kind of a dick, Goku isn't as strong, like, Krillin, it's not clear if you don't know the original show if he's playing up him being stronger in his memory, or if he actually was. But the most surreal part of it, for people with no context of Dragon Ball, is that they're both wearing giant purple turtle shells the entire time.
That's true.
And it's just like, what is happening? Okay, we're back now. Well, that scene happened.
But
I live here.
But can we talk about the Z Sword for a minute?
Yeah, let's talk about the Z Sword for a minute. What are your thoughts on the Z Sword? Because I have just like... I am deleting everything in my brain that has to do with the Z Sword as soon as it comes up, because I know this information won't be relevant.
So the Z Sword has been around for generations.
Yep.
Even the mightiest of Supreme Kais has never been able to wield it. But Gohan...
Or broken the rock around it, sure.
But Gohan can.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, why can Gohan do it? Is it going to be because Gohan has a purely unselfish goal? Is it going to be because Gohan is pure of
Maybe.
Heart? Is it going to
sure.
be because Gohan, like, while Gohan is fueled by rage, that rage comes from a place of righteousness? No, Gohan
no.
can just pull the sword out because Gohan's really strong.
Yup.
Like, really?
Yup, he's the strong dude.
The reason
He's
that Arthur could
guy.
Pull the sword out of the stone was because he was the rightful king.
Yep.
Thor can lift Mjolnir because he is worthy. No, Gohan's just really strong.
Yep.
Now, you'd make the great point of also, why not just destroy the rock around the sword?
And we get kind of a reason for this?
You might think, oh, well, the sword's magic. So the rock's probably magic and can't be destroyed, right?
Maybe.
Sure, except that while Gohan's trying to pull the sword out of the stone, his feet do break through the rock as he's pulling it out.
Yep.
So it's just normal-ass rock. Why doesn't he just vaporize the rock and grab the sword?
I mean, you could point out that it's probably useless because you wouldn't be able to lift the sword anyway, and maybe the Supreme Kais knew that, but... It's weird.
It's again, you can already tell that Toriyama's heart isn't in this subplot. You can see last episode, he had a cool idea. Ooh, what if Gohan goes to, like, the Kai realm and gets a magic sword? That's awesome. I'm gonna do that. And then this episode...
Sweet, do it, man.
We get to, all right, so there's a sword in the stone, and so Gohan has to pull it out, and, he tries to pull it out, but it won't come out, so he turns Super Saiyan, and then he can pull it out. Yeah, like
you. But then it's real heavy.
Yeah, like you can see the gears turning on this subplot, but it's the gears of like one of those machines where you push a button and then it opens up, and a little cat paw comes up and turns itself off.
Yeah,
like it's the gears turning on a useless robot.
Yep. What did you think of this week's Gilmore Girls?
The Lane plot was fun.
Lane plot was fun.
I do really want to talk about how much I liked that last scene. It was small, but I enjoyed it. In general, I like this episode. We're still getting more depth for Mrs. Kim.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen much of Mrs. Kim this season up until this point, but I really liked where they left Mrs. Kim last season, of her really finally coming to a place where she's starting to understand her daughter.
I think it's also kind of interesting that when we've seen Mrs. Kim loosen up a bit before, there could be the argument, at least for the first time she kind of came to terms with Lane, that it's weird that she loosened her faith for this. And it would be easy to say that her drinking alcohol, when that's probably out of line for her denomination, I don't know the rules specifically for Seventh-day Adventists, but this is something that at least she publicly teetotals. This one actually has some theological grounding, just a little bit, because a lot of the strictures about alcohol are either if you can't handle it, like if you're going to abuse alcohol, don't use it in Christianity. But the other thing is, a lot of the strictures are around the weaker brother. Basically, you know, Paul talks about how it's totally fine to eat meat that's offered to idols, if I remember correctly, because idols aren't real. They're blocks of wood. Like, if it got offered to a block of wood, it's still a steak. But if there are people with you who previously had worshipped idols or who would be concerned about that, you should choose not to when they're in your presence, because it would be a stumbling block for them. Even if it's not a stumbling block for you, you should watch out for the other people. And so her closing all the doors and windows to have a drink isn't necessarily like she's doing something bad and trying to hide it. It's that she strongly believes that this could be a stumbling block from other people, but she trusts herself and she trusts Lane, and this is something she wants to share with her. And I really liked it from that perspective.
I didn't think about it that way. I saw it as just a her wanting to hide the fact that she's doing it.
I mean, that's possible.
Yeah, either way, I think either way, it's still an interesting angle on Mrs. Kim, that it's not like this is something she does regularly. Like, she doesn't shut all the windows and have a glass of sake every night. But she keeps it in the back for basically for emergencies. Or for special occasions, or just for when it's appropriate for the situation.
Yeah.
And the fact that Lane was surprised to see it means it probably has not been such an occasion for 21 years.
Either that it's not an occasion for 21 years, or, like, the other interesting possibility, and I wish we got more Lane, because then we would get more on this, Lane has been very good at hiding her life for 21 years. I mean, at least 18.
What if Mrs. Kim was hiding the alcohol just like Lane was hiding the records?
I mean, if Lane was spending a lot of time and energy making sure she had parts of her life cut off from her mom, there were probably lots of things she didn't notice.
Yeah,
like,
so like
where Mr. Kim went.
Yeah, so like I really enjoyed that. It was a short plot, but I liked Lane just being grumpy. I liked that Mrs. Kim had to be the one to tell Lane to tone it down.
Yeah, no, angry Lane selling chairs is everything I want and more.
Yeah, and yeah, I really liked how that came together. I also honestly, like, for the most part, I still think the overall idea is blah, but if we're gonna do this, I feel like the Luke plot was executed pretty well this episode, except the very end.
The very end, yeah, they just keep finding reasons for him not to tell her that don't make any sense.
Yeah, like him not telling Lorelai at the end made absolutely no sense, and I hate it. But everything up to that point, I want to give credit. Like, I really liked that scene of him and Anna.
Yep.
It was honest, it was believable, and it made sense. And, like, then he, like, that cycle of he goes over, he asks why she didn't tell him. He gets her explanation. He kind of sort of takes the easy way out by saying, I just want to support you monetarily, because he doesn't want this to screw up his life. And not necessarily screw up, but to change his life.
Yeah.
But then he sees her and he realizes
Luke's not big on change.
Yeah, he sees her and he realizes, oh, no, I can't. I need to have this girl in my life. I can tell that she's going to be important to me and I need her. Like, I want this kid in my life. And so he makes that choice to kind of blow up what he's got going here in the interest of being a part of his daughter's life, finally. And it's frustrating that this culminates in him not telling Lorelai about it. It would be so much more powerful if it culminated in him saying, like, even if it was still that you're perfect, he kisses her and he says, there's still something I really need to tell you. I feel like that would have made that scene so good.
Or even just cut it. Just, like, cut to it. I have a daughter. Roll credits.
Yeah, like, you're perfect. I have a daughter. Like, that would have been a cheap way to end the episode, but it would have worked.
There, well, and there's a bit of writing advice that I heard. It might have been from Brandon Sanderson. It was definitely on the Writing Excuses podcast, but I really like it, where they were talking about cliffhangers, and I'm probably screwing up the wording, but basically that a bad cliffhanger is, and then I saw dot, 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 and you have to turn the page or go to the next chapter to see what they saw.
Right. A good cliffhanger drops a bomb on you and then leaves.
Yep. And then I saw space aliens.
Yeah. I haven't read a lot of Sanderson, but I've read enough Sanderson to know that that definitely came from Sanderson. Like, my brain tricked me into a really bad habit while I was reading Sanderson, because I quickly caught on that he really likes to do that, to end a chapter on a big twist. So you have to turn the page. And so when I would turn the page and I would see that on the next page was going to be the end of the chapter, my eyes would just subconsciously dart to the end to be like, oh, there's going to be a twist. So I'd be like, ooh, end of the chapter. Fuck! And so I'd keep spoiling the reveal for myself by darting my eyes over just unconsciously. Yeah, so like, it was this Luke plot had a really, really nice arc to it, and then just fell off a cliff at the very end. And that's really frustrating, because they could have stuck the landing and like gotten me hooked. Not necessarily like suddenly okay with this April plot, but this could have gotten me to, okay, let's see where they're going with this. But where they're going with this is still Luke isn't going to tell Lorelai for increasingly stupid reasons until she eventually finds out. They're going to blow up about it and break up. Like,
yeah.
Like, I now know where the rest of the storyline is going to go, and I hate it.
Yeah.
There
are some nuances, but you're not entirely wrong.
Yeah. So, much like the Z-Sword, I can see that April is just going to make me upset. The Rory and Lorelai plots were both bad. Whoa, do you have any questions about Dragon Ball Z Kai?
When, like, previous episode, Kibito had the clothes ray and put...
Yeah.
Gohan into the clothes of a Supreme Kai. Did he pierce Gohan's ears? Were Gohan's ears pierced, or are those clip-on earrings?
You know, that's a great question that I was just pondering the other day, because Kai earrings do become actually an important plot point later. And I was anticipating that you were eventually going to ask if they have their ears pierced, because a couple different people wear Kai earrings over the course of the Dragon Ball saga in general, in Z and Super.
I just want to imagine Bulma, like, lining them all up in front of an icing by Claire's.
Yeah, like, I don't...
And, like, them getting the studs for 2 weeks that turn their ears a little green, and then they have to get, like, ones shaped like cupcakes.
Yeah, I don't have a good question for that. Maybe the... I mean, Kai earrings are magic, so maybe they just can go on even if your ears aren't pierced?
Maybe.
Or maybe they're clip-ons.
Maybe.
I don't know. That's a great question, though.
Why does the Z-Sword make Gohan's hands glow?
I think the idea there is supposed to be that it's so heavy that his hands are chafing.
Oh, they were pink and glowy.
Yeah, but like, you know how like in a cartoon...
Magic chafing.
You know how like in a cartoon when like Bugs Bunny smashes Daffy Duck's hand, it starts like pulsing and glowing red?
Yeah, it just didn't quite look like that. It looked like, you know, a bath bomb went off.
Yeah, I think that's what they were trying to go for, though.
So what is with the turtle shells?
Master Roshi wears a turtle shell sometimes.
He does?
Yeah, he doesn't wear it a whole lot in Z, but he wore it a lot more in the original Dragon Ball.
Okay.
Because his whole thing is that he's the turtle hermit, and he's the master.
He's the turtle hermit.
He's the master of the turtle style.
That doesn't mean you have to LARP at Roshi.
Apparently it does. So when Goku and Krillin were disciples of Master Roshi way back in the original Dragon Ball, they had to wear the turtle shells.
Okay. How does this whole Majin Buu psychic network work that he can concentrate on Majin Buu or Babidi, and you can get a through line to them psychically at any time?
Magic.
And just any citizen can do that, but for some reason, even though he can feel that, he can't feel a ton of people on the Watchtower worrying about Babidi, even though they're all presumably concentrating on Boo and Babidi.
A wizard did it.
A wizard did it. Okay.
Literally a wizard did it.
Literally a wizard did it. That's all the questions I've got. Do you have questions about Gilmore Girls? The real secret at this part of the series is that I don't have answers for any of your questions.
Yeah, the only questions I really have about Gilmore Girls are just going to trigger another 10-minute rant about Logan, and this episode's already running long, so...
Here, just ask me them. We can cut them.
No, I mean, it's just, why does anybody like Logan? There's no nuance to it. It's gotcha. Just, dear listeners, Logan still fucking sucks. I do want to point out we had a fun 2005 Easter egg in this episode. That when Luke is on April's website, there's a page counter at the bottom, for starters. To our...
Because that what used to be a thing.
Yeah, to our listeners who are the youngs. Back in the day, before, like, social media, websites, like, everyone had their own personal website. And not everyone, but a lot of people would have their own personal website on, like, GeoCities or Angel Fire. And you could...
That is a name I have not heard in a long time.
You could design them with widgets and backgrounds, and it could play Linkin Park when anybody logged in.
There was glitter text, and your cursor looked like a rainbow.
Yeah, it was the best thing ever. It was
so awful.
It was the internet wild west. It was awesome, as opposed to now, when you just jump between the same five websites forever. So, a thing you could get was a little widget called a hit counter or a visit counter that would just count how many people have visited your website, so you could prove you were popular because a lot of people had visited your website. These fell out of fashion not too long after this episode. This goes a level deeper, that the number of hits that April has on her website is 1,337. 1337, or as some of the olds listening to this podcast might remember, leet. Now, leet, because in internet number speak, right? The one's an L and the threes are E's and the seven's kind of a T. We just kind of pretend. Just stick with us here, okay? We didn't have emojis back then. It's spelled leet, which is short for elite, like you're awesome. It means you're cool. Usually in the context of being good at a video game, but not necessarily. So
I want a headcanon that April set her own page counter to leet, just because there's no way 1,300 people visited that website.
Oh yeah, 100% she did. So I like to believe that this was just like a random intern at the network got told to build a really basic web page to use as a prop in this episode. And then said intern was like, I'm going to make the page counter be leet. That's going to be so cool.
That is how we all talked in 2005.
It is, and that was the peak of coolness in 2005. So you go, Gilmore Girls intern.
Who do you want to swap?
Oh, this week I want to swap Kibito and Anna.
Okay.
Because Luke would come over and be like, Kibito, why didn't you tell me that I had a daughter? And Kibito would be like, it is useless for you to attempt to monetarily support us, Luke. We have never wanted for anything, and even the most powerful of Supreme Kais in generations of old have never been able to actually contribute to the raising of me and my precocious daughter. And then, like, Gohan would, you know, be trying to pull out the Z-Sword, and Anna would just be like, we don't need you, man. We're doing fine. The Supreme Kai and I got this covered. Like, you know, I could just go back to Earth. We'll take care of Majin Buu on our own. We don't need your help. And then when she gets back there, Yamcha would immediately hit on her. Because Anna Nardini is definitely Yamcha's type.
That's true. I want to swap Luke and... Let's go with... I could go between Goku and the Ox King, but let's go with the Ox King.
Okay.
I would swap him with Vegeta if Vegeta was there, but he is not. I want to see Luke coming in and it's like, hey, Bulma, why didn't you tell me we had a son? Well, you were on the moon. Okay, but can I contribute financially? I own the Capsule Corporation. Can I see him? You own a diner? Also, you've never practiced in 10 times Earth gravity. Trunks is better than you, but maybe on the weekends. And then meanwhile, just the Ox King glumping around Anna Nardini's bazaar, and I say that without the E, like bazaar, like a marketplace, house full of pillows and candles and other things that she's selling. Like, Anna Nardini in 2018 would definitely be selling a bit essential oils.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Actually, I do have a question about this episode of Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
How is Anna Nardini supporting a daughter as a single mother when she sells pillows and candles?
How does Lorelai run an inn when she's literally not there for days on end?
But the inn, like, she has employees that can keep the inn running when she's not around. The inn generates money. The question of how the inn generates money is not in question. How does she make enough money to support... cost of living is lower in Connecticut. Never mind.
Cost of living's lower. Maybe they already owned the house, or she got help from her parents getting a house. And so it is just cost of living and not necessarily rent. And if it is a tourist town, because it seems like she lives in Woodbury, which seems to be a slightly larger town near Stars Hollow that gets probably some of the same tourist traffic Stars Hollow gets, I could see tourists tromping out to the quirky lady's house where she can sell pillows and candles.
Yeah, maybe she's just wildly successful.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, go on with your swap.
So I want the Ox King just breaking everything in Anna's Bazaar while saying that he wants to be friends with April.
Yeah, that'd be good. And then the Ox King, also a widower, can hit on Anna Nardini.
Instead of punching people in the face, this week we said, who could hit on Anna Nardini? Gilmore Ball Z, don't say we don't change things up.
Look, I'm a married man, but Anna Nardini's a snack.
What woman on this show isn't a snack?
I mean, some of them aren't my type.
Don't know what to do with this information. Yeah. Thank you for listening. Join us next week when we have a detailed rundown of food categories in the Women of Dragon Ball and Gilmore Girls. Who's the snack that smiles back? Anna Nardini.
Well, that's Gilmore Ball Z for this week. Thank you all for listening. You know where to find us. Our Facebook is Gilmore Ball Z. Our Twitter is at Gilmore Ball Z. Our email is gilmoreballz@gmail.com. And our WordPress is gilmoreballz.wordpress.com. Feel free to reach out to us, email, comment, whatever, on all those platforms. And if you haven't yet, go ahead and drop us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Facebook, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Reviews and ratings really do help, and they make us feel good. So please go ahead and do that if you haven't. So with that, thank you all for listening, and we will see you next Saturday. So, will we get an explanation for how the Z-Sword works before it becomes irrelevant? Who will be the next Gilmore Girls character to run a shop out of their home? My money's on Paris, and it will be deadly. And speaking of Paris, would she lower her power level to fuse with Rory? Find out next time on Gilmore Ball Z.